Welcome, it's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll be going into the archives to pull out a staff favorite, Rick Dulock's pick of an interview I had with Johnny Tillotson a couple of years ago. He had a number of hits on several different charts with Poetry in Motion, Talk Back, Trembling Lips, Dreamy Eyes, and more. That's coming up later in the program. First, though, Emmanuel Rogers checks out a new book, a new TV show, and will quite possibly leave you hungry.
Joining us now is Stephen Reichlin, author of 30 books, host of 7 TV series, and esteemed instructor of Barbecue University, smoking and grilling of many foods, not just meat anymore. Today we are discussing your new book, Project Fire, cutting-edge techniques and sizzling recipes from the caveman porterhouse to salt slab brownie s'mores. Thank you for joining us, Stephen.
Thank you.
This is a great joy for me because I spoke with you about your book, Project Smoke. And last time we talked about your book, Project Smoke, where novices like myself learned that smoking meats, veggies, fruits, and other things didn't have to be a scary venture. What makes your new book, Project Fire, such a great companion to Project Smoke?
Well, Project Fire is really the bookend to Project Smoke and a book about grilling as opposed to smoking. So you already are an expert on the art of smoking. This is going to help you take your grilling to the next level.
Stephen, grilling has been around for thousands of years. What is caveman grilling and what types of foods can be cooked using this procedure?
Well, caveman grilling is actually one of my favorite methods. It's basically grilling directly on the embers. So you don't need a grill grate. In fact, the cover of the book, it portrays a T-bone steak that is grilling right on the embers. What this does, you get a smoky char, you get an incredibly savory crust, succulent, moist meat. And, of course, it's a very dramatic cooking technique. So, you know, it's a great way to show off. When people watch you drop a $100 steak directly on the embers, first they think you're crazy, and then they think you're a genius. So, you know, it's important never to underestimate the importance of performance and showmanship when you're grilling.
Okay, because that was still scary to me just listening to you talk about dropping that steak right on the fire. But, okay, now you brought this up because most people do grill the most basic foods because they have such a fear of destroying good food and, you know, how much it costs. How does Project Fire help allay such fears?
Well, you know, first of all, with step-by-step photos that show you step-by-step how to do it, and then with what we call beauty shots to show you what it should look like. So it's pretty hard to mess up the procedure. You know, I mean, remember, we've been grilling for over a million years.
Okay.
But at the same time, you know, while I'm trying to make you relax, remember also that there are lots of innovative cutting-edge grilling techniques that may be new for you, like cedar plank grilling or like salt slab grilling or grilling on a plancha, which in effect a plancha is a sort of griddle, cast iron griddle that you put on your grill. You put some wood chunks on the coals. You get a nice smoke flavor, nice sear. So very compelling.
Well, before I go on to the next question after this, where can our listeners find out more information about the book Project Fire and other work you would like to highlight?
My website is barbecuebible.com. That's BarbecueBible.com. And while you're on the site, sign up for our Up and Smoke newsletter. It's a free biweekly newsletter. Gives you the latest recipes, grilling tips, reviews of equipment, interesting restaurants that I've been to. It's a great resource for all things grilling.
Thank you for helping us not to mess up everything in the backyard.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, have a great summer.
We're looking forward to it. I'm heating up things now, and I'm trying not to be so afraid because little tips you give, like soaking the wood chips. That's been a debate for a long time in my area where some people soak them in water, some don't. But I have found, just like you suggested, soaking them for a little while does help get a better flavor.
Yeah, the idea is when you soak a chip, you know, if you put a wood chip directly on a hot charcoal fire, it's going to catch fire in a couple of seconds. And when wood catches fire and burns, it's not producing smoke. It needs to smolder for smoke. So by soaking the chips, you actually increase the smoldering power.
All right. Now, Stephen, also, we're going to be playing Project Smoke here at KVCR beginning May 13th, starting for the summer series. Do you have the companion show, Project Fire, ready to air, or when will this series be available?
Project Fire is launching on Memorial Day weekend. We taped it in Southern California. Super excited about the show. In addition to all the how-to work that we do with the previous shows, we actually have field trips this year, so you'll get to meet some of the grill masters and restaurants that have inspired me.
That sounds great. So will there be food there for sampling?
You know, they haven't invented taste-o-vision or smell-o-vision yet, but I think that you will find the recipes in the book pretty inspiring.
Okay. You know, that's how some of your guests actually do. It's like, okay, we're glad to see you, glad to meet you. Where's the food?
Right, exactly. Well, here is virtual food, but I hope looking at the pictures in Project Fire, they made you hungry.
Well, not only did they make me hungry, but I'm ready to buy some cuts of meats I don't normally put on the grill and try them out. So I'm jazzed about this.
You know,
I really am.
Those are some of my favorite words to hear when somebody says, I don't normally do X, but your book has inspired me or made me comfortable to try it. That makes me feel terrific.
I'm Emmanuel Rogers, in conversation with Stephen Reichlin, PBS cooking show host and author of Project Smoke, Project Fire, and many other projects. Now, with grilling becoming more and more complicated, digital thermometers, specialized grills, and so on, how do we cut out some of those complications yet still put together a great meal for friends and family?
First of all you really need to do for grilling, you need a set of spring-loaded tongs, a grill brush, and an instant-read meat thermometer. All the remote digital thermometers to talk to your phone and everything, I mean, they're fun, and, you know, they are convenient, but I wouldn't say that they are absolutely essential. A good instant-read meat thermometer, yeah, that is essential, because you do want to cook to temperature. You want to respect certain food-safe temperatures, like taking hamburgers up to 160 degrees, chicken up to 165 degrees. That is very important.
Okay. So basically, all the other things are just nice to have them.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, Stephen, will you share with us about your school, Barbecue University, and teaching folks how to grill with confidence? Where do you teach, and who can attend your workshop?
Absolutely. So Barbecue University takes place at the Broadmoor Resort in Colorado Springs. We get everything from private chefs to people like Michael Dell and Calvin Klein. We get people who want to open barbecue restaurants, people who just love grilling, want to learn about it. We've had fathers and sons. We've had mothers and daughters. It's a super fun experience. And you can learn about that on barbecuebible.com.
All right. And in this case, there will be actual meats to sample as your students are cooking.
Oh, yeah, the students cook lunch. The students do all the grilling, and then lunch follows, and it's the lunch they prepared.
Oh, this sounds just so great. Let me ask you, what are some of your most favorite dishes to teach novices and favorite dishes in your book?
Well, I would have to say the caveman T-bone on the cover of the book is one of my absolute favorites. It is very dramatic. It's very flavorful. It's a real showpiece. Some other favorites in the book, let's see, a cocktail. It's a grilled citrus fruit sangria. By grilling the fruit, you give the sangria a kind of a smoky caramel flavor. Another favorite dish is the salt slab grilled chocolate brownie s'mores. Those are made instead of with the traditional graham crackers. They're actually made with chocolate brownies. Pretty awesome.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Now, how do you come up with the ideas of cooking desserts on a grill? Where does that come from?
I've been grilling dessert a long time. You know, I mean, I guess I first got the idea in Thailand, where grilled bananas are very popular street dessert, grilled pineapple. But it just seemed natural that the whole meal cooked on the grill. I mean, the high dry heat of the grill caramelizes the plant sugars and fruit. It's a great way to finish off the meal. If you were to come to dinner at my house, the entire meal would be cooked on the grill.
Wow. So, I mean, what other kinds of desserts do you do besides the s'mores? Because that looks really good. It does.
Well, there's everything from cinnamon grilled peaches, where you make little kebabs of fresh peach using cinnamon sticks instead of bamboo skewers. That's a good one. Grilled pineapple that's flambéed with rum. There's smoked whipped cream, which is great. Grilled pine, grilled pound cake. We have grilled macadamia mango crisp. It's pretty awesome. And there's even a Bellini, which is a traditional Venetian cocktail made with fresh peaches and Prosecco. And you guessed it, I grill it.
Now, I'm also curious about something I saw in here because I love Reuben sandwiches. You have a Reuben here in pork. Does that come off the same as a Reuben sandwich as far as the taste and the flavor?
Well, yeah, if you think of it, what are the kind of the keystone flavors of a Reuben sandwich? It's pastrami with that briny, spicy flavor. It's piquant cheese and then the tart sauerkraut. And in this dish, you use those flavorings as a stuffing for a pork loin. So pork loin in place of the rye bread. Think of it as a high-protein version of a Reuben sandwich. I just love it.
Yeah, and I think my audience is just going to really dislike us right now because they can picture this, probably can almost smell it, and can't touch it right now. But now, you have a little section here. You say, you know, you can grill what? And I'm looking at this, eggs, bacon. Okay, bacon I get. Figs, watermelon, artichokes, beets, and squash, and even kale. How does one do this, and can this be done well on a basic pit?
Absolutely. I mean, grilled vegetables, you know, if you think about it, the high, dry heat of the grill caramelizes the plant sugars, gives you flavors that you, you know, just wouldn't normally associate with grilling. And as far as I'm concerned, in my book, everything is fair game for the grill.
Wow. I would love to spend so much more time talking with you about this and other things you have done over the years because there is so much. But our time is coming to the end. Stephen, is there anything you would like our audience to know about your book, Project Fire, that we haven't covered?
Well, I'd just like to mention that there is a Project Fire TV show coming to PBS Memorial Day weekend.
All
so
right.
In that show, the book will come alive, and you'll also follow me as I travel around to some of the top grilling restaurants in Los Angeles and Southern California. You've got the website, barbecuebible.com. The book makes a great present for Father's Day or Mother's Day, we should add, because more and more women are firing up the grill. You know, I think we all kind of fall into this rut, and we grill the same four or five things over and over again.
Yes.
This book is designed to really help you take your grilling to the next level.
All right. Well, thank you, Stephen, for joining us. And I would love to be able to talk to you again at some point during the summer.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Anytime. Thank you.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Stephen Reichlin. You can find a lot more at StephenReichlin.com. Also, you can see Project Fire on KVCR-TV Sunday afternoons at 2. Up in just a few minutes, we'll hear from Johnny Tillotson. Poetry in Motion, Talk Back, Trembling Lips, Dreamy Eyes, and more. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming.
Welcome to Shout, Black Gospel Music Moments. I'm Robert Darden. Gospel music comes in all kinds of musical shapes and styles. There is a powerful choral work of the Mississippi Mass Choir, the hard-charging quartet sound of the Mighty Clouds of Joy, the hip-hop funk of Ty Tribbett, but few artists have attempted to reproduce the joyous gospel swing of Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Sister Rosetta was gospel's first superstar in the 1940s and 50s, and she was a flamboyant figure, playing arenas and clubs, wearing full-length fur coats, and dazzling with her guitar-playing prowess on a silver national guitar. So when I first heard this battered 45 by the Maddie Whitaker Singers, I was blown away. I'm So Glad sounds like Sister Rosetta, even down to the swinging barrel house piano. Maddie's vocals make her sound like Rosetta's twin sister. I don't know much about Maddie Whitaker. I know she died in 2015 at age 80. But this 45 sent me scurrying into the vaults to see if there's more.
Well, you know I'm so glad. You know I got my religion in town. You know that I'm so glad that I got my religion in town. Then I'm so glad. You know I got my religion in town.
I'm Robert Darden. Shout, Black Gospel Music Moments, is produced by KWBU, the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University Libraries, and is funded by generous support from the Pritchard Foundation.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. For the remainder of the program, it's Johnny Tillotson. To the best of my knowledge, he's not performing in the area soon, but every so often we'll be re-airing a staff favorite, and this one is Rick Dulock's. Tillotson had a number of hits on several different charts, pop, country, and more, with Poetry in Motion, Talk Back, Trembling Lips, Dreamy Eyes, and others, but he got his start very early, as a child. Early on, between moving back and forth from your home in Jacksonville to over where your grandma was living, You ended up on some TV shows, including, didn't you even have your own TV show early on at WFGA?
Yeah, I had my own television show. That was in Jacksonville, and we didn't have the big buses and things they have today, so we would drive up sometime from the University of Florida to Jacksonville, where we did our television show.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yeah, looking at the timeline on this, I understand WFGA was the first television station in the United States that was designed for color broadcasting. So was your show in color?
I think we were in color.
And you had to have realized, for lack of a better word, the groundbreaking.
Absolutely.
I don't know the right word for that, but that was a brand new thing for so many people. Now, also early on, you got noticed for singing in the Pet Milk Contest. Was there a theme song for Pet Milk, or was it just a contest that they were putting on?
No, they, along with WSM, sponsored a Pet Milk Talent Contest. And a local disc jockey found a tape of mine and sent it into Pet Milk, and all of a sudden, we were in the contest, and we were one of the, I think, six national winners. So, of course, I had a chance to go to Nashville, and I took my tape along with me of original songs. And at the show that night, a lady named Lee Rosenberg came up to me, and she said, "The crowd really loves you, and I was just wondering, do you write songs?" I said, "Well, I do." And she said, "Well, you know, Archie Blyer is in town. He records the Everly Brothers." And I said, "I know that." And she said, "Well, would you like me to get the tape to Archie so he could, if it's something he might like to record?" And so that's how that started. And we got it to Archie, and Archie called back in a few days, and he said, "My daughter really likes that song, and she says you sound like half of an Everly Brother." So that's how that started.
You mentioned this getting you to Nashville, but I don't believe you mentioned that this got you to the Grand Ole Opry. How old were you at this point performing at the Opry?
Well, this was just a special opportunity to perform at the Grand Ole Opry. And I used to go over there with Johnny Russell. I thought, too, that what a great honor to be on the Grand Ole Opry. I used to listen to it on Saturday nights. Always loved country music, and I loved the Grand Ole Opry.
Well, now, one of the things that I just really took to note, I guess partially because of the fact that I took so long to get my bachelor's degree and had so many adventures in between, but with your TV experience and even performing at the Grand Ole Opry and all that, all of these things were before you finished your bachelor's degree. And maybe I should put it this way, that despite relative success in music at this point, you still kept going back to finish your bachelor's. Did you?
Well,
have
I had promised my parents that I would finish school and get my diploma from the University of Florida, and I didn't want to let them down. So I got a bachelor's degree in journalism and communications, which helped me a lot in my work.
It looks like that was in, I guess, around 1959. After you finished your degree, you did go off to New York with the intention of music, I suppose not so much journalism, your degree. And so was it at this point looking for labels, or just really like an actor or any singer or whatever, looking for any job and then recording singles as you may? How did that experience work for you then?
Well, I had met Archie Blyer when he was in Nashville, and I told him that I wanted to record. He said, "Well, why don't you come to New York?" I said, "Well, I don't have any money to come to New York." I said, "I mean, I really don't have any money."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll send you a ticket, and you can fly up to New York. My wife and I and daughter will pick you up at the airport, and you can just stay with us. And what we'll do is we will try to find hit songs. And trust me, we won't squander your money. We won't go in a studio unless we have something that we think is a hit. And also, I'll look forward to you doing some writing for me." So everything just worked perfectly. I've written Dreamy Eyes and Well, I'm Your Man, and which is kind of like a Buddy Holly thing.
Mm.
So that's kind of how I got in with Archie, and I was perfectly happy. I stayed out at the house with Archie and Janet right up until Poetry in Motion, and I think I probably overstayed my welcome. But all we did is look for hit songs. Because he said, "You know, we can record all the time, but you really want to just record when you have something that you think is going to be a hit. And it'll be better for your career and better for everything."
Well, starting in, it looks like, around 1959 and releases in 59 and 60, a succession of singles, True True Happiness, Why Do I Love You So, And one in particular that I want to ask about, a double-sided single, Earth Angel and Pledging My Love. Now,
right. With
Earth Angel, this was given to us by the Penguins in 54 and then the Crew Cuts the next year. You did this around, I think, 1960. So I'm curious if this song was still popular on the radio, or by the time you did it, was it looked at as sort of a try to get this as a resurgence?
Archie always liked the song. He thought if he could put Pledging My Love on one side and Earth Angel on the other side, that would be a good way to come out with a product especially aimed at that market, kind of like a doo-wop sound. You know what I mean?
Well, certainly. You had a lot of sweet music, a lot of beautiful melodies, and this was really...
Right.
So was this actually an attempt at a bit of a crossover to the R&B genre?
He just always liked Earth Angel and Poetry in Motion, and he had such a good record of picking songs that turned out to be hits. I could see where that might be a good thing, and in our concerts, we always do Earth Angel, as a matter of fact. So the audience seems to like my version quite a lot.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a tune that you can't go wrong with.
Those are special memories, for sure.
It's a great,
I think that's
great
one
music.
Reason that the music stands the test of time. All these songs bring back such wonderful memories of people when they're just first starting out in life, and they're first dating, and all of those great magic things that happen to you. The music just kind of reinforces that.
Songs or albums or whatever all take us back to some place or another, whether it's the malt shop or the drive-in or just walking home from high school. Who knows?
You know, we do a thing called Rockin' in the Caribbean.
Oh, yeah?
And I just came back from that. We did 2 weeks. It was on Freedom of the Seas, and that was a very, very good concert. We had Bowser, and we had a whole bunch of folks.
Oh, wow. We were speaking of Bauman just the other day with Sonny Turner and the Truth in Music legislation, all that kind of thing.
Right.
Wow.
He's a great guy.
I would love to meet him at some point. That's Music in Conversation with Johnny Tillotson. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Before we move on, we were talking about these various singles. Were singles more of a focus than albums in the late 50s, early 60s?
Yes, they were. The albums really started to sell around in the early 60s, like 1961, 62. But before then, it was mostly singles. You're absolutely right.
Okay, so there probably wasn't a lot of thought put into, well, this song would follow this one and make an entire flow of an album. They were just truly a collection of singles that would fill up 44 and a half minutes.
Right, but then when the Keeps Right on a Hurtin' came along with Ray Charles' Modern Sounds of Country Western Music, they started at that point doing an album that, for example, It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'. The album It Keeps Right on a Hurtin' has all kinds of wonderful country songs and country pop songs that make it very special. So they started in about 62 to do that. That was a very big break for me because people loved It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'.
When I see my baby, what do I see? Poetry, poetry in motion.
Things specifically about Poetry in Motion, a lot of the singles that we were just speaking of, they all reached, say, the bottom half of the top 100 or so, but then you came in with Poetry in Motion. This was written by Paul Kaufman and Mike Anthony. Were they, by chance, were Kaufman and Anthony writers for the label, or did they find you somehow? How did this one work, getting Poetry in Motion?
They were writers, and they co-wrote on the song, and they wrote every day in a little writing studio, and the way the song came about, they had tried all day to come up with something that was clever and something that was good, and they just hadn't hit upon it that day. So finally, they decided, well, why don't we just not worry about it and take a break? They got a Coke, and they walked over to the window, and they started looking at these girls walking home from school. And Mike or Paul said to the other one, you know, that's Poetry in Motion. And I said, well, why don't we write something that's complimentary to girls and the way they move and the way they smile and call it Poetry in Motion. And it was a good idea because people all over the world could relate to somebody who was Poetry in Motion.
Oh, wow. I guarantee you, after we hang up, I'm going to be going back and re-listening to the lyrics to look at it that way. That's incredible.
Oh, it's a very complimentary way. And when we do it in our shows, quite often I'll just dedicate it to all the ladies in the audience. Because it was written about them, you know?
Beautiful, and every single one of them is receiving it sent to them. That's really cool.
That's right. Well, it was done intentionally. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, when this was recorded, when I noticed this, this was recorded in Nashville with folks including Boots Randolph and Floyd Kramer. And now when I think of Floyd Kramer and Boots Randolph, I mainly think of them alongside Chet Atkins. So
right.
When you recorded Poetry in Motion, were Kramer and Randolph at this point simply contracted session musicians, or were they already the go-to Atkins, Floyd, and Boots power trio that they became?
Well, when we recorded in Nashville, we always requested Lightning Chance and Bob Moore on bass and Buddy Emmons on drums. Hank Garland sometimes. They called them the A-Team, and we always were lucky to get the A-Team. And on Poetry in Motion, I had recorded it first up in New York, and it was good, but it wasn't quite in the groove. Archie said, well, do you want to go down to Nashville and do it there? And I said, yeah, and we could even do the horn part on saxophone, Boots Randolph on the horn. So we flew Boots in from Evansville, Indiana, and he played on that part. He did a great job, too.
Oh, yeah. It was exciting to see his name along with Floyd Kramer on...
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the A-Team, as they were called. And anytime you walked in with the A-Team, you always thought your chances were bigger and better, that you really had something magical.
She's much too nice to rearrange poetry in motion. Life seems so empty since you went away.
This song has been referenced a couple of times now since we've been speaking, but it was around this time that we got one that you wrote. It keeps right on a hurtin'. Very specifically, Johnny, the line that follows that, it keeps right on a hurtin' since you're gone. And I can see so many people taking this song as a yearning for a girl or a lost loved one in another fashion. And listening to the lyrics, I have to say this isn't a stretch at all. But would you mind please sharing what the actual inspiration for this song was?
Well, I had wanted to write a country song for Buck Owens.
Okay.
And so I sent the song up to Buck Owens, and he liked the song, but he'd already recorded. So I showed it to Archie Blyer, who owned Cadence and so forth. I said, what do you think of the song? He said, well, I think we should do it with you, because he liked what I did on the demo. And he said, let's go in and put it down with you. And so we did It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'. And Anita Kerr did the high part on It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'. And while we were recording it, she took a break and came over. And she said, you know, Johnny, I think that's a hit song. And she was right.
Now, wasn't this actually, though, if you don't mind going there, wasn't this actually written because of a terminal illness of your father?
Of my father, yeah, that's correct.
But when it was written, though, it, again, it could be easily taken.
It could be written from a standpoint of a lost girl or anybody that's suffering loss, you're right.
Absolutely. So was that intentional to try to leave it open for interpretation?
Yes, that's right.
Nice.
Exactly.
That's really nice. Now, and I find it interesting to note that I think that while you were pretty much coming up in the world of music, you were coming up in the world of Elvis, and he ended up covering this tune, It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'.
Quite a few people recorded It Keeps Right on a Hurtin'. You know, Dean Martin, Billy Joe Royal, mm-hmm. Conway Twitty. But when Elvis recorded it, that was really special because he was my favorite singer, recording artist, and promotion person. It was Elvis. I just loved the fact that he would think enough of my song to want to do it. And he put it in an album that was a big album called From Elvis in Memphis. which had In the Ghetto in it and some great songs. And I'll never forget, I was with him in Las Vegas. He said, Johnny, can I talk to you a moment? And I said, sure. And he said, you know, I on your song that I recorded, he said, you know, I changed some of the words on the second verse. I said, Elvis, it doesn't matter. You could have changed the title and I wouldn't have cared. True. But he was that kind of guy. If he knew that you wrote the song, he wanted to make sure that he wasn't taking advantage of you.
That's really cool, I have to say, for him to be literally and figuratively the king, but still to say, well, Johnny, I've got a favor to ask of you. I mean, that's incredible, you know?
It was really something, actually. He changed a couple of words and was it all right? And I said, sure was.
Nice.
And I can't help it. I don't think I can go on. And it keeps right on a hurting since you're gone.
Well, since we're speaking of Elvis briefly, I think around the time of Poetry in Motion, or maybe right after Poetry in Motion, there was kind of a point where you were featured in some of the Teen Idol magazines. And now I can see the excitement of being placed next to Elvis and Ricky Nelson and all, but also I could see where it could be sort of a, hey, it's all about the music, man. Don't make me into the Teen Idol category. So,
oh, no, I like the Teen Idol.
Yeah, okay.
We
screaming,
did the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars tours on the bus, and all of us guys really kind of lived for the fact that we were lucky to have so many wonderful fans. And those fans were really important to giving us hits. You know, today when people come to the show, they relate, you know, wonderful times that they've had because of the music. And it means a lot to us. So I like it. I like it. Sometimes they put me next to Annette Funicello. And anyway, yeah, I like that.
Well, it had to have been complimentary, and I don't see as a 22-ish year old or 20, whatever you were at that point, just turning something like that down.
There was a song, Without You.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That there's a doo-dooby-doo-dum-dum. We took that, and we applied it to You Made Me Happy, You Made Me Dum-dum-dum-dum. I borrowed that little sound from the other record, the dum-dum-dum.
Right.
So, and then a little narration. So we tried to change it around a little bit so it'd be different.
Nice.
And I think that record did pretty good too, didn't it?
That was one of the biggies for you.
Maybe tomorrow. Dum 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 dum. Maybe in time. Dum 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 dum. I'll find an angel. Dum 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 dum. Who wants to be mine?
Music in Conversation with Johnny Tillotson. More with Tillotson just ahead. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming live at kvcrnews.org.
Talk back, trembling lips, shaky legs. Don't just stand there.
Don't let her know that she's getting through to you.
Talk back, trembling lips, burning eyes.
Well, after a bit, the Cadence label folded, and you moved to MGM with, I read, your own production company. And what
That's
you came
right.
out with then was Talk Back, Trembling Lips.
We started off with Talk Back, Trembling Lips.
Now, this was a cover.
We needed a song mm-hmm. that would show that we've made the transition to a new label, And there's nothing better than to make a transition than to come up with a hit song and a hit record. So we came out with Talk Back Trembling Lips.
Talk Back Trembling Lips. Shaky legs, don't just stand there.
Don't let her know that she's getting through to you.
Talk Back Trembling Lips. Burning eyes, don't start.
And that was my first release on MGM.
And it did well for you, too. I know that that
it
one got
sure
to
did.
Number seven, I believe.
Now, you're right, exactly yeah. right. I remember that myself.
This was a cover of something, though, that had been number one on
Ernest
the country chart. Yeah, yeah.
I was in Nashville, and I was listening to Ralph Emery, and they played this song by Ernest Ashworth. And I said, you know, this is a very interesting piece of music because it's got this bouncy kind of melody, but yet in reality it's kind of sad. It means, you know, talk back to shake your leg, and it's
yeah.
different. And so I thought that might be a really big song, and I was right on that one. So Talk Back Trembling Lips was top seven, and that kind of launched my career with MGM.
Was there any initial concern, do you recall, that you were pushing for the song, and rightfully so, it had kind of a walk in the floor over you, sort of just a nice propelling beat to it, but was there any initial concern that this was a perceived country song, you know, it might be looking at you in a different direction?
No, I think the fans saw a continuity between It Keeps Right On A-Hurtin' into Talk Back Trembling Lips. It had a certain continuity to it. You follow what I mean?
Oh, certainly, certainly, yeah, yeah.
When we went to MGM, we brought with us Talk Back Trembling Lips, and that made the transition very smooth.
So talk back trembling lips, shaky legs, don't just stand there.
Don't let her know that she's getting through to you.
Talk back trembling lips, burning.
You're breaking in two. Heart, don't let her know that you're breaking in two. If you're in doubt about angels being real, I can arrange to change any doubts you feel. Wait till you see my gadget. You're headed for a big surprise. The way she walks, the way she talks, you won't believe your eyes.
Now, this is a bit of a sidebar, but there are people, let's just say they were living under a rock and not hearing any of these wonderfully popular tunes that you had going left and right. Whether or not people knew your name, okay, people ended up knowing your voice, perhaps weekly, with a very specific television theme song. So
oh, you must be talking about Gidget?
Absolutely.
Wait Till You yeah. See My Gidget was written by Jack Keller and Howard Greenfield. We just loved doing that song.
How did this come about?
I had known Howard Greenfield and Neil Sedaka and Jack Keller for a long time, and I happened to be on 57th Street, and Howard waved at me, and I waved back, and he said, wait up just a minute. So I went over, and he said, listen, we're going out to the West Coast, and I'm writing some themes, and we've written a song for the TV show called Gidget. It's called Wait Till You See My Gidget. Would you be interested in recording it? And I said, sure. I didn't even have to hear it. But I just love the whole idea of, wait till you see my Gidget, you want her for your Valentine. And I said, I think ladies will really enjoy that song. And they did. They like Wait Till You See My Gidget a lot.
Wait till you see my Gidget, you want her for your Valentine. You're gonna say she's all that you adore, but stay away. A Gidget is spoken for, you're gonna find. That Gidget is mine.
I'm curious if singing a TV theme seemed like an opportunity.
Yeah, that was exceptionally exciting. The fact that I hadn't done that many TV themes, it was a new exposure for me, and I liked it very much.
Well, when you do this sort of thing, singing TV themes and whatnot, mind you, I'm not asking you how much money you made on that, but I do want to know, is it a case where you get paid to go into a studio and sing something, or is it more like there's a back end, there's a percentage every time Gidget airs?
Well, that's a good question.
Thank you.
It was kind of a career opportunity to be something that was going to turn out to be such a big record. And so you would accept doing Wait Till You See My Gidget as a career move more than a financial move. So Charlie Colello, he had done a lot of the Four Seasons things.
Oh, wow.
And he said, I'll do the arrangement. So they did the arrangement, and then I just sang it. But I felt really good about it. I felt that we had really done a good job on Wait Till You See My Gidget, and Sally Field liked it, and everybody liked it. So money was not a big deal on that. It was just another song that I wanted to do. Except this one is going to be the theme for a TV show.
Okay. There's actually one of the nice things about this one song is that it's a song that not only is a fun TV theme, but it actually is a theme that can be listened to independently just as a fun song in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. It's very complimentary to, Gidget's like America's sweetheart.
Oh, yeah. That's Music in Conversation with Johnny Tillotson. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Well, now, in addition to doing the TV themes, you ended up in a film here. And you may or may not admit to this one, but it's public knowledge at this point. You appeared in the 1966 comedy The Fat Spy, which also had Jane Mansfield.
Wasn't that voted the worst movie ever?
Yeah, that's my question, too. Well, you got to number 46 of the 50 worst movies ever made with that movie. So.
That's right.
Yeah, what was the involvement?
I was happy to get it. You see, here's the story behind The Fat Spy.
Please.
We heard that there was some interest in me doing a movie. And I said, well, tell me about the movie. And they said, well, Jane Mansfield is in the movie.
Oh, gotcha.
And I said, say no more. I said, I'd love to do the movie, just have the opportunity to meet Jane Mansfield. But the sad part is, they were shooting on the lot. So I went there a few days ahead in order to say hello to Jane Mansfield. What I didn't know was the movie business, and Jane had come in the week before, and she had done all of her takes, and she was no longer there. And I was so disappointed.
Oh, no.
And I said, well, where's Jane Mansfield? She said, well, she was here a week ago. And I said, well, she's not here now. She said, no, but Phyllis Diller is here. Now, that was kind of sweet because I got to know Phyllis Diller, and we became friends all through her wonderful life. And she was the sweetest gal. So I felt we turned a kind of disappointing situation into a really positive thing with her. And she was just the greatest. So I thought you might like to hear how it went from Jane Mansfield to Phyllis Diller.
Oh, my God. I mean, with all due respect to Phyllis, of course, she played up on it herself. But, yeah, if you were expecting Jane Mansfield and you got Phyllis Diller, but so nice that it became a friendship afterwards.
Oh, yeah, it was very, very nice.
That's incredible. This may be
and
the
none of us that did the movie expected it to get such bad reviews. We were kind of crushed, but that's the way it goes.
Okay, but you accepted it. You wear the badge with
Rolled
honor.
On, yeah.
Okay.
And told people we came close to meeting Jane Mansfield.
This close? Well, that's closer than I ever got, so.
Namida kun sayonara. Sayonara namida kun, mata auhi made.
Another movie, a Japanese movie, Namida Kun Sayonara, and you apparently...
Namida Kun Sayonara, yeah. Well, that was the big hit for me in Japan, so Namida Kun Sayonara. It was a story about an American artist going to Japan to perform, and of course I sang my number one hit that was number one in Japan, Namida Kun Sayonara. That was kind of a cute little movie. I don't think anybody rated that badly. But Namida Kun Sayonara was a really fun little movie to do because I was basically playing myself.
Do you know if you can still track that movie down? Is it out there anywhere?
I'm sure it is, if you just look it up on the computer.
Okay, back to music then, Johnny.
Okay.
Although I started this list of questions with questions about Gidget and Jane Mansfield, and it worked around from there. But regarding music, you seemed to be recording and releasing every couple of years or so through the 60s and into the 70s. In the early 80s, you did chart with Lay Back in the Arms of Someone, and then it also seemed to be in the 80s that you seemed to be the rage of Southeast Asia and Australia and New Zealand. You seemed to stay busy with tours.
Well, that's right. We were very fortunate that our songs were so well accepted in places like Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore. And all of these wonderful people knew the songs. So when I would go into Poetry in Motion or Cutie Pie or She Understands Me or whatever, they would know the songs. And I was curious how they would remember the songs. And they said, because when you sing so clearly. And we were able to learn the words, even though sometimes I'm not sure they knew all the words. So Thailand is one of our major markets all through the years, and Malaysia too. Those things, they were done because there was a legitimate reason for me to be there, because we were very popular. And just like today, we take engagements in Thailand and Singapore and Malaysia because we have so many fans, and we're so grateful to the people for remembering our songs and having us back time after time.
Well, that's a treat, and that when you've had a career that spanned as much time as yours to be able to go to any spot in the world, you know, it'd be one thing to think, hey, my songs will be picked up in Detroit, but to be able to know that it's popular in Thailand, Malaysia, New Zealand, that's got to be a wonderful feeling.
It was, and it still is, you know. I get very excited when I'm going to Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore. And of course, we had hits in Japan. Del Shannon and I toured with Dusty Springfield in England, and so we had, with the foreign markets, that's been very helpful to me.
Wow, that was just the Poetry in Motion little runaway tour. Wow, nice.
Yeah, the Poetry in Motion went to number one, I believe, in England.
Well, now, jumping up 40-some years, tell me about the 2010 release, Not Enough. It was a tribute song.
Yeah, it was a song that we wrote. It was our way of thanking our servicemen for all the sacrifices they make it and that they make. Just saying thank you is very important to the people in the service, but it's not enough. You can say more. You can do more. So it's a very patriotic song called Not Enough.
Did I thank you? Not enough. Do we thank you? Oh, not enough. All the ones who guard the gates on the path where freedom waits. Did I thank you?
That reached number one on the indie country chart, I see, and top 25 on another chart, breakout single on Music Row in Nashville. And that really brings me to something that, stylistically, between Not Enough and going back to your early hits, during the course of this interview, Johnny, we've spoken of teen idol magazines and pop charts and country pop, indie country. At the beginning of this, you did mention that you had an appreciation for country music early on, but still, we're looking at going all over the charts, and I'm wondering how much of this is you're trying to do something country, you're trying to do something pop, or if it's just music that you're making, and where it ends on the charts is because of public perception.
That's right. It was public perception. I love doing country music, and I love changing the arrangements just enough so that the songs would be accepted in the pop field and the rock field and the adult contemporary field, just spreading that market out more. But the main thing we always looked for was, do we have a song that sounds like, if it's recorded, that it could turn out to be a hit record? So that's why some of the songs like Heartaches by the Number and Send Me the Pillow and Dreamy Eyes, and we had markets for all those songs. So that was very helpful. Did that make any sense?
you had songs and you were looking for hits, and that's what you enjoyed singing, but some of these hits could end up country or could end up pop.
Well, that's right.
Nice.
You got it.
Nice. Excellent.
Well, I enjoyed this interview so much because it brought back to mind all kinds of things that have occurred to me. And I'm just so grateful for all the fans and all the disc jockeys that kept my music going. It hasn't stopped. It's still going.
Beautiful. We just heard from Johnny Tillotson. Again, to the best of my knowledge, he's not performing in the area soon, but every so often we'll be re-airing a staff favorite. This one was Rick Dulock's. And that just about wraps up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Johnny Tillotson, Emmanuel Rogers, and with Project Smoke and Project Fire, Stephen Reichlin. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Jessica Greenwell, Isel Quapio, and Benjamin Perper. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year at kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.